The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I think now, just like the Cold War was not a traditional conflict, but was something that I think rightly was called a war that required dedicated will, that was in a state of essentially low-intensity conflict and required a strategy to win. We are similarly now in an era of code war. There are multiple countries committing low-intensity conflict operations against the United States, North Korea, Russia, Iran, and China. They have different tactics and strategies. But one of the reasons I wrote the book is I realized when I talk to boards of directors, to CEOs, to the general public right now, that much of what they think is science fiction and possible threats that may come in the future have already happened, but those stories have not been told.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 24th, 2018. John Carlin served as the Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division of the Justice Department from April 2014 to October 2016. In his new book with Garrett Graff, called Dawn of the Code War, Carlin explains the cyber conflicts the U.S. faces and how the government fights back. Benjamin Wittes sat down with Carlin last week to talk about the book. They discussed how the FBI and Justice Department is fighting against cyber theft. They talked about how the Justice Department attributes cyber attacks to the responsible actors, and about Carlin's experience as then-FBI Director Robert Mueller's Chief of Staff. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 367, John Carlin on Dawn of the Code War.
John, I'm excited to talk to you about Dawn of the Code War, but before we turn to that, I would be remiss if I didn't start you're one of two people, to my knowledge, who has both run the National Security Division of the Justice Department and served as Chief of Staff to Bob Mueller.
I'll do a quick correction because I believe there are three, because Ken Weinstein, Lisa Monaco, and I all served as both Chief of Staff to Director Mueller and head of the National Security Division.
You know, I forgot that Ken had also served as Chief of Staff to Bob Mueller, so fair enough. So it's still a very small group of people. And I want to ask you, first of all, about the mood in your former division at Justice. You must be in touch with a lot of people. It's a difficult time for the Justice Department. So how are people holding up?
It's a fantastic group of prosecutors who are motivated by mission, like Bob Mueller himself. And so I think there's a lot of right now discord between parties, but the folks in that division are focused on those who want to harm us as Americans. So when you get up in the morning and your job is to protect innocent civilians from being killed in terrorist attacks, and you know the stakes of getting that right, you stay motivated. And similarly, there was an initiative that we can talk about a little bit more later that really springs from much of what we talk about in the book in terms of the threat we've been seeing in cyberspace from China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and you look back about 2 weeks ago now to the initiative that the Justice Department announced to crack down on Chinese economic espionage until the behavior changes. That's the sort of threat that gets those prosecutors and trial attorneys up in the morning.
But surely amidst the business as usual, which is what you're describing in the counterterrorism and the counterintel space. It is not business completely as usual when the president is, you know, publicly undermining the mission in important respects. And I'm, you know, I'm curious what the intersection between the work of the division and the sort of public politics, except when you have like Edward Snowden like events, is pretty near zero. And now it can't be near zero because you have the president out there publicly commenting on all kinds of pending matters. And so, like, I'm just interested, what does it do? Yeah, people are still motivated, get up in the morning, do their jobs, but it can't have no effect on the way people think about what they're doing every day.
Yeah, let's divide it into two things. So one are the prosecutors and trial attorneys, the law enforcement agents at the FBI, the intel analysts. Are they motivated and going to do their job no matter what type of crazy talk there is in the rest of Washington? Yes, I believe that they are. But that's different than the attacks on our institutions and the undermining of public confidence in those institutions. Undermining of public confidence in those institutions can affect your ability to develop cooperators, witnesses, foreign partnerships, and ultimately, it's a strength of our country and one of the reasons why our country is both envied and feared by authoritarian countries is because we've been able to carve out apolitical institutions. I mean, the Department of Justice is the envy of the world for that reason. So just like those agents and prosecutors are motivated to protect us from terrorists and those who would do us harm, we need people in both parties of good conscience to stand up and say it is utterly inappropriate to direct the Justice Department to not bring a prosecution for political purposes or vice versa.
Your successor in that role as head of the National Security Division, is this somebody you look at and say this is in the bipartisan tradition of leadership of that department? As in, should the average listener of this podcast think whatever's going on at the, between Matt Whitaker and the president, but with the Mueller investigation, the National Security, the division of the Justice Department, is in good hands both at the career level, which you've already said, and at the political level?
Yes, the Assistant Attorney General now in charge of the National Security Division, John Demers, is someone I've known for a long time, dating back to law school, and worked with when I was at the FBI, and he served in the National Security Division under one of those other Mueller proteges, Ken Weinstein. And he is someone who is dedicated to protecting the national security interests of the United States, and not political. And if you look at the leadership below that of the National Security Division, it has stayed almost entirely in place, as it should be. And we've seen this will be the third administration now where there's been a continuity because national security professionals are not driven by party.
Let's talk briefly about Bob Mueller, who shows up periodically throughout your book. You were his chief of staff, and, you know, he has gone on to play a role very different from the role in which you served under him. How do you read, like, from having worked very closely with him, what is your read on the state of play with respect to the investigation?
You know, Ben, he's a good example, and tells some stories about it in the book, of not just a person who does his job with extraordinary competence. And when you meet him and work with him day in and day out, he's someone who seems like he sprang from the pages of a history book. He's someone who's utterly dedicated to the mission at hand, to trying to follow and solve problems and facts and apply the law, and has a humility about the application of the law. So that's him just in terms of being a competent individual heading this investigation. But there is also what he represents. And we talked about a little bit, and there is this increasing rhetoric to try to turn the Justice Department partisan. He personifies and motivated people not with great speeches, but with the life that he led, to dedicate themselves to a nonpartisan, mission-oriented Justice Department. And that dates back to his service as volunteering to go into the Marines, where he ended up not just risking his life, but saving the lives of others, something he, by the way, did not talk about. It was almost impossible to get him to talk about that time in his life, but it had a great resonance for him. His pride in a Marine, being a Marine, he would talk about, to his time as a career prosecutor, to the legend that I knew when I went to the Washington, D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office as a line prosecutor.
I know exactly what legend you're about to say, but it's a great story. So flesh it out.
Yeah. So this is someone who had risen up to something that required Senate confirmation and a presidential appointment to be the top official at the Justice Department in charge of all criminal prosecutions. He then left, tried going to a private firm for a little bit, decided he hated it, missed the mission, and went back to be a line prosecutor doing the equivalent of state and local crimes in Washington, D.C., to be a homicide prosecutor, because he'd always wanted to serve in that type of job. And so when I joined the U.S. Attorney's Office, everyone knew about Bob Mueller, who was there trucking his lit bag over to court and trying homicides.
Let's turn to the book. What is a code war?
So I think now, just like the Cold War was not a traditional conflict, but was something that I think rightly was called a war that required dedicated will, that was in a state of essentially low intensity conflict and required a strategy to win. We are similarly now in an era of code war. There are multiple countries committing low-intensity conflict operations against the United States, North Korea, Russia, Iran, and China. They have different tactics and strategies, but one of the reasons I wrote the book is I realized when I talk to boards of directors, to CEOs, to the general public right now, that much of what they think is science fiction and possible threats that may come in the future have already happened. But those stories have not been told.
You start the book with a story that is very connected to stories that we're used to hearing, right? So the post 9/11 radicalization stories, only you treat it as a cyber story more than as a terrorism story. Talk to me about the relationship between the code war and, you know, what we used to call the war on terror, right? Or, you know, sort of global counterterrorism operations. Because as I was reading the introduction to the book, one of the things that it's trying to do, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong about the literary aspiration here, is to tie these two things together and you know, have the reader understand that he or she is reading the story of Anwar al-Awlaki and Adam Gadan, but reading it as a cyber story rather than, or as a cyber and terrorism story, rather than simply as a sort of next wave al-Qaeda story.
So it's, I call it the blended threat. And what we're seeing now in the cyber arena or in the Cold War arena is a new challenge or a new problem. And to me, the problem of terrorism and what we were seeing in cyber were increasingly starting to blend and conflate. And what's new is that companies are on the front lines of national security threats. And you think about the reforms that have taken place, billions of dollars, new departments and agencies, Director of National Intelligence, Department of Homeland Security, and the division I led at the Justice Department, the National Security Division. They were all designed to get better at fixing the problem that cost innocent lives on September 11th, and that is the failure to share information at speed and scale across the law enforcement and intelligence divide and with foreign partners. And we did get better at that, and we were able to disrupt Al-Qaeda 1.0 and its strategy of recruiting operatives who physically moved over to Afghanistan, Pakistan, were trained, vetted, deployed to try to commit attacks on the scale of September 11th. But with Terrorism 2.0, the Islamic State in the Levant, it becomes a story about our technology. So just like Al-Qaeda used aviation, a Western innovation, against us, we were seeing the Islamic State in the Levant or ISIS use social media and crowdsource terrorism. And at the tip of the spear of that campaign was a computer hacker. It was someone named Junaid Hussein, a British citizen who had been convicted and served time for computer hacking, became radicalized, moved to Raqqa, Syria. And what I start in the book is a true case. And when I go around and talk to companies, it's not a risk that they're used to thinking about, but it's a real risk in today's blended world where what looks like a pure computer hacking case, so a relatively actually not that sophisticated computer hacking attack, steals a small amount of names, addresses, personal identifiable information from a U.S. company with a trusted name where customers have given them that information. That guy asked for $500. He was an extremist from Kosovo, and he actually moved to Malaysia. He was 21 to get access to better bandwidth, believe it or not, in part. And so using that better bandwidth, he then works with a fellow extremist in Kosovo. The two of them hack into this U.S. company, steal information that's entrusted to them, ask for $500 through Bitcoin. So from the perspective of the company, if they don't work with government, it looks like a low-level criminal computer hack for $500. But from Malaysia, he becomes friends with Junaid Hussein, that extremist from England who's moved to Raqqa, Syria, and they only meet through Twitter. They exchange direct messages.
That's like half my friends I only know through Twitter.
Watch out. They may not be who they appear to be. Although in this case, I think
they knew who they were.
In this case, they did. And you see Junaid Hussein convince him, hey, pass over that information to me. And Junaid Hussein could care less about $500, right? What he wants to do is what the Islamic State does, which is kill with and murder people, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, with impunity. At that time, they were bringing women and children into slavery, and they were using rape as a political tool. So instead of getting $500, what he does is take this information, personal information, entrusted to a U.S. company, turn it into a kill list by looking for whose email address looks like their military or state police, and then pushes it back through Twitter and says, kill these people where they live. We were able to take effective action, and that's why I can go into so many details that were otherwise untold in the book, so that you can tell we were able to work with the Malaysians through the State Department, get Farizi arrested, and he's serving 20 years in Virginia for his crime. The first time we charged computer hacking and terrorism in the same indictment. And Junaid Hussein was outside the reach of law enforcement in Raqqa, Syria, and was killed in a publicly acknowledged military strike by Central Command. But think about that, you know, Ben. When we're talking about the new national security issue that we face, that's five or six different countries. It required sharing information at the speed and scale of cyber. And I think this is the challenge of our time, as hard as it was to get better at sharing information within and between governments, we cannot combat that threat unless we give information to the private sector at the speed with which we're seeing it, so they know what the risks are and can plan for them, and vice versa. We need the information from the private sector so we can do things like action, military responses, law enforcement responses, diplomatic. And when it comes to that sharing and that transformation, we are not where we need to be.
So is it fair to say that the defining feature of the full-blown code war is that it hybridizes with other national security threats, that it requires net speed communications within the U.S. federal government between agencies and components, between the U.S. government components and foreign components, and between all of those components and the private sector?
Yes, I think that is fair to say. And look, for a long period of time, this is part of the story I know you've covered before when we tell, but inside the Justice Department, you know, when I was a line computer hacking prosecutor, I worked with a great squad at the FBI, but we just did criminal cases. There was another squad behind a locked, secure, compartmented door that did intel. Occasionally an agent would switch squads and poof, they disappeared, never to be seen again. And when I even when I coordinated that program nationally on the criminal side at the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section, we still were not seeing what was occurring on the intelligence side. It wasn't until I went to work for Bob Mueller, who was then relatively anonymous and merely the director of the FBI, that the door opened and I was able to see what was going on the intelligence side. And we didn't change approaches. And what I saw, by the way, was horrifying, right? I saw it was great intelligence, but there's giant jumbotron screen, and you could watch in real time as China in particular would hop into places like universities, go from the university into companies. And then we watched what Keith Alexander, former head of the National Security Agency, called the largest transfer of wealth in human history. We watched and had a great graphic user interface. When I say watch, I mean, we literally were watching billions and billions of dollars of intellectual property, trade secrets flow out of the United States. And so we were tasked with watching isn't good enough. That's not strategic success. It comes from an understandable mindset. I mean, for years, that was the approach when you were doing counter-intel espionage operations, because what you were seeing was, I think, at a small enough scale that you could map out operatives inside the United States. And for years on end, maybe forever, you wouldn't disrupt, because that might make it harder to find where the spy network tried to penetrate next. Instead, you would wait, watch, pass them fake information, and it was part of a much slower speed cat and mouse game. Important, but a different way of tackling it. That mindset was still there, but it was totally inapplicable when it came to the scale that we were seeing with cyber, and the fact that it was causing real damage to real companies now is bankrupting people, putting people out of work. It had consequence, which meant we need to get better at disrupting it. And when you think about where we are today, it's still really recent that we switched to taking that attribution that we were doing out of the shadows, because we were doing a much better job of it than people knew, and having a new strategy where you figure out who did it, but then you make it public and impose consequence. And it wasn't until 2014 we brought the first case of its kind.
So I'm going to get to that, but there's a huge amount in here that I want to unpack, because there's a lot of threads in the things you just said, and I want to start try to untangle them. So first of all, you're describing that the intel is much better than people think it is. And I want to home in on that for a sec. It is pretty common to talk about an attribution problem. You have argued in the past, and we have seen some pretty dramatic examples, starting with the famed ugly gorilla indictment, the PLA, which you call the PLA indictment, but will always be ugly gorilla to me, that actually the attribution problem is at a forensic level very solvable. And so I want to start with that and just ask you, is the attribution problem solvable at scale, or is it only solvable in the cases that are high profile enough and important enough and rich enough that, you know, people in your former roles decide, okay, we gotta throw everything at this one? In other words, and the reason I'm asking this is because it seems to me to matter a lot if you say, hey, if you're a hacker out there, we can get you, than to say, if you're Icarus and you fly too close to the sun as a hacker out there, you're not safe. Like, in other words, don't be too good at it, or we'll get a drone after you, or we'll arrest you or indict you. But if you're just a workaday guy stealing a lot of money, being a cog in that giant wealth transfer, and you know, presumably siphoning off a little of the wealth yourself, we don't have a solution to that problem yet. So I'm interested in your thoughts. At what level have we solved the attribution problem?
Yeah, maybe we break it into categories. So first, there was an assumption of story. I met a guy who he used to work at CNN. Now he's switched networks. And when you go to see a cyber hacking story, watch TV and look for the fingers. And he was the fingers on the keyboard. He just was someone working at the station. And so what they did is they videoed him typing at a keyboard. And then every time they had a hacking story, it was this faceless person. And you just saw the fingers.
Is there a hoodie?
And with a shadowed hoodie, yeah, right, exactly. in the background. They're still using that visual. And so until we started changing this approach and naming people and also changing the way we were investigating the cases, because when you're doing attribution for intelligence purposes, you don't necessarily need to get down to the face behind the keyboard. But when you're going to out them or bring a criminal charge, you do. So it required a change in the way that we were producing and analyzing the intelligence. And one reason I go into the book, and they're just great stories when you look at exactly how and the mistakes that people were making, and their ways that people can learn from how they do the attacks. Some of these attacks we've been seeing are done the same way for the last 20 years, can increase your ability to protect yourself. But also, it shows we are able to get into that type of detail, do the attribution, and it is not true that you need to remain a faceless hacker. And it's true with lots of other types of crime as well, right? If you're a smart criminal, you try to keep yourself below the radar so no one's looking for you, which is part of the answer to your question. And so those are the crooks that are hardest for us to catch. And those who rise up above the radar and people complain about are the ones that get the most resources. So we're much better at attribution than people think. And we're starting to make that clear by bringing case after case and making it public. You raise a second question, which I think is less the nation state activity and more the low level crook. And a couple thoughts on that. One, increasingly, there is a massive organized criminal industry that's highly segmented, that's multi-billion dollar trade. You know, if you go on to the dark web today and literally could just give you the site, you could go on and right now, you can go to a site that looks just like Amazon. And when I say it looks just like Amazon, I mean, it's got 5-star reviews. And so you can say, I want to buy stolen credit card numbers. And there'll be a review that says, I've bought from this crook before, and the vast percentage of these work. He's a great crook. And then the ones I always love, there'll be a 1-star review, and it'll say, I bought from this crook and he's not trustworthy. And you're like, what did you expect? You're buying
dealing with a crook.
You're on Amazon for criminals.
He's an undercover FBI agent.
Which is a good way to deter. But in fact, in one of these cases, a great justice case that was brought in the last year, the name of the group was literally In Fraud We Trust. That was the motto. And you had to sign up. So
I like the pairing of the word fraud and the pairing and the word trust.
Yeah, never know. And I think partly, you know, in terms of different tactics, just like we have with other criminal enterprises, by undermining that trust, increasing the degree of difficulty, showing that we do takedowns, it makes it harder and it will have less of a scale problem that we have now. And as you neck down the scale, then it becomes also easier and easier to apply resources. And we've had other seemingly intractable criminal problems where we've used that method before and it doesn't happen immediately, but you end up seeing a sharp reduction in crime. Where it links with the nation state problem though, and we'll go back to that idea of the credit card thief, is let's use a case like the Yahoo case. There was an individual where he was on the top 10 most wanted list by the FBI for credit card fraud. And we tried to get cooperation from Russian law enforcement, just like we get with child pornography and other cases that really have nothing to do with nation state disputes. But everyone agrees, or we thought, that crime, certain types of crime are bad. So they asked, hey, can you help us arrest him? Here's the evidence. Not only did they not arrest him, but they signed him up as an intelligence asset. Said, keep stealing, and also we're going to give you taskings for the state. I think right now our organized criminal problem is in large part a Russia problem. They are shielding. You look at case after case that's brought. People are arrested all over the world, but not in Russia in the same conspiracy. They are shielding and using organized crime as a way to make money as part of their economy, a way to task for intelligence, and as a way to disrupt the world order. And until we work with like-minded partners to hammer them with increased costs for that behavior, we're not going to be able to solve this issue.
So that's, just to be clear, not fundamentally, that response you're describing is not a cyber response, right? It's a Russia needs to pay a price in the international, presumably economic and political space for its support and cooperation with organized criminal groups, much the way we say, you know, Iran as a state sponsor of terror needs to pay a price for that. That may not be, you don't do that by launching terrorist attacks against Iran, right? It's kind of a, but it's a using non-cyber assets to punish code war kind of behavior. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So the way to think about it is, you know, it's fundamental to having a strategic approach to attack your enemy where they're weak and you're strong. And the fact of the matter is, we moved further and faster than any other country in the world to take everything we value from analog space, books and papers, to digital space, bits and bytes. And we did so systematically in government and in the private sector without calculating what the risks were if bad guys wanted to attack that information where it was now vulnerable because it uses a protocol, the internet protocol, that was never designed with security in mind. So we are playing a massive game of catch-up where people are just now, I think over the last couple of years in government, in private sector, starting to think of this as an area of risk they need to manage, getting better educated on what those risks are, and making rational decisions. So we are more vulnerable than other countries in that space. So to use an example, talk about lived through with North Korea attacking Sony Motion Pictures. Knocking North Korea offline is probably as many IP addresses as just the Brookings Institute alone has, right? Not going to be a fundamental deterrence to their behavior. If you want to attack them or impose consequences back to deter that type of behavior in the future, you need to instead focus where we're strong, which often is in the financial sector. They're weak, to change behavior.
All right. So let's talk about these indictments. When you guys brought the PLA indictment, and for those who do not remember, this was the first case where we, and by we here, I mean you, since you were the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the time, named names of individual hackers working for foreign intelligence agencies to steal U.S. intellectual property. And the indictment was an uncommonly good read, just as a matter of prosecutorial storytelling about something, you know, how this operation had happened. It followed a pretty amazing bit of private sector forensic work on by the Citizen Lab and, you know, and, you know, other kind of private sector groups on this particular advanced persistent threat. And there was a lot of criticism of it, including from my Lawfare colleague, Jack Goldsmith, which, you know, the nature of the criticism was, hey, you're never going to get custody of these people. You're giving up significant intelligence secrecy in order to do this. It's not going to change Chinese behavior. And so other than sort of the U.S. government thumping its chest, what does it do? So I've been thinking about this debate, and you and Jack had a kind of public back and forth about this. And I've been thinking about this a lot because, of course, you could make exactly the same criticism of Bob Mueller for the hacking indictment and the Internet Research Agency social media indictment. In the Russia investigation case, both of which we don't have custody over the people, it's presumably not going to, you know, Vladimir Putin's not going to say, oh my God, they've prosecuted people. I can't keep hacking people anymore. So we've now had a couple year, few years of these indictments happening and the responses to them happening. And I'm interested for your thoughts on, first of all, what is the history of this type of indictment so far? And what is the evidence that it does anything other than make us all feel good?
So I think you're right, and then I'll back up, that that is where the Justice Department is now. They are moving full speed ahead with this approach that began with the first public indication was the indictment of those five members of Unit 61398, a specialized unit of the People's Liberation Army.
You can say Ugly Gorilla.
Went by the moniker Ugly Gorilla there to make you happy. But that
my favorite part of that indictment.
I always think, too, I think former Director Comey talked about Chinese economic espionage being so noisy it was like a gorilla going around your house. And in this case, that's literally what he called himself. The Ugly Gorilla went around your house. So you can draw a line from there to the Justice Department now continuing a strategy of figuring out who did it, making it public, and seeking to use not just the criminal justice system, and I'll back up on that, but not leaving the criminal justice system off the table and instead using an all tools of government power to raise the cost. And you see that not just with the case that Director Mueller brought in his role as special counsel, which I would argue is vital to not just whether or not we bring them before a court of law, but to educating us about what the threat was. And now you've seen that with a case that was moved from the special counsel to the National Security Division. The current Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, announced a new policy at the Justice Department, which said we are going to our policy presumption is, this is around September 25th, we're going to make public signs of election interference that we see before the election. Then under seal out of the Eastern District of Virginia, not brought by the special counsel, was a case that was returned in a complaint that said they laid out how the Russians' activity wasn't just in the past, but charged someone with attempting to interfere in the 2018 election.
This is the Elena Khusyanova case.
Exactly. And that strategic announcement that we're going to make it public and then following through shows that they're committed to this approach. And let me back up on why I think that is the right thing to do.
Yeah, so I have no doubt that it exposes information. It puts stuff out there. It really, shows that there was this operation, which has important collateral domestic political effects since the president denies the premise, right? But I'm interested in it from a cybersecurity code war point of view. What does it get you?
So one, and this is about bringing it out of the shadows. One, it educates those who need to protect these systems on what the threats are by giving it in real and credible detail. So when a company is trying to figure out how much to budget on putting in new systems to protect itself from cyber attack, and in 2014, this was still very much the mindset, needs to move from a mindset of thinking, hey, if I just get the right IT guy, I don't understand what they say, but if they just get the right guy, they're going to fix this and keep the person out of my system, changing that mindset to one that recognizes there is no government or private sector system that can keep a dedicated adversary like the second largest military in the world out of your system. So you need to move more towards a risk management resilience mindset. By the way, a change that the government needed to go through as well, which we saw in the Office of Personnel Management. So one, educating. Number two, I often use this example for non-lawyers. You have many lawyers who listen to your podcast, but think of an easement. So this is the idea in common law that if you let someone walk across your lawn long enough, they get the legal right to walk across your lawn. And that's why we put up no trespass signs. Well, international law is fundamentally a law of customary law. And while we were accepting the gorilla banging around the house where everybody could tell that it was China and they were stealing and weren't even hiding their tracks. I mean, they weren't even using proxies. They weren't even using servers that hid their identity, really. You knew it was coming from China when you were a company. As long as we were tolerating that, saying nothing, keeping it classified, keeping it in the intelligence space, we were making international law. Doing nothing did something. It created international law that said it is okay to use your military and intelligence services, just like traditional spying services have been recognized under international law. It is okay to use them to target private companies for the benefit of their competitors overseas. And that's why facts matter. You look at that case, it's things like Westinghouse doing a joint venture. What the Chinese uniformed members of the military are stealing are not state secrets. They're stealing the technical design specifications for a lead pipe. So the next morning, the joint venture partner no longer has to pay to do the lease. Or the solar company that is in that case that got driven into bankruptcy because they stole the pricing information, used that stolen information to price dump. After they price dumped, to add insult to injury, when that company sued for unfair trade practices, they stole the whole litigation strategy. Private companies cannot deal with that type of threat alone. And we put an attachment to show what that threat is. And what it was is those PLA members, this activity started 9 in the morning Beijing time. They get up, put the uniform on, go to work, hands on keyboard, start hacking into U.S. companies to steal money from them, essentially. And then they took a slight break from noon to 1, lunch break. The activity increased again, decreased overnight and on Chinese holidays. That's both the prosecutor and me would call that circumstantial evidence as to who did it. But also it shows this really is the military's day job until we change the behavior. And then lastly, I fundamentally believe you can change the behavior. This is a cost-benefit analysis. And when we did nothing, of course, it was a good way, instead of spending funds on research and development, it was easier to steal it. Why not? It's completely cost-free. Can you imagine what the National Security Agency could do and other of our professionals if, as part of their mission, it did not matter if they got caught? That's a crazy way to try to change behavior in the world. And I'll say, we thought this was the beginning, and it has been the beginning of a new approach. I was surprised by how much of a difference one case, that case, and then there's another case we talk about in the book that has really not been talked about before, which is the case of Su Bin. China knew, and we were taking all this criticism, and we weren't going to say it publicly because we didn't want to interfere with the case, that this is just name and shame. You're never going to actually put people in jail. But China knew that we had. There was a case we had brought. An individual named Su Bin in Canada had been arrested pursuant to U.S. charges for a conspiracy to hack into Boeing and other companies. So China knew there were real teeth and real criminal charges. And in fact, they tried to pressure Canada to release him. Canada stayed strong, extradited him, and he's done real jail time. I think that case plus Su Bin plus the president raising it repeatedly diplomatically, and the new executive order on sanctions, which we can talk with a little bit more, convinced China that the cost was getting too high and led to a breakthrough where President Xi agreed that you shouldn't use your military and intelligence agencies to target private companies for your private financial gain. And that led to the G20 adopting it. It led to it now being understood as part of international law. And we did see, and this still surprises me that it happened so quickly for a period of time, a change in behavior where we saw a decrease in that particular type of attack. Both the private sector saw it, CrowdStrike, Mandiant, those firms in that space, and in government, a decrease in the behavior. Now it seems to be ticking back up again, which to me doesn't show that you shouldn't raise costs. It shows that we're going to need to raise costs again.
Or maybe it shows that if you have presidential leadership that really not merely takes its eye off of this particular ball, but denies the premise that foreign adversaries are in fact attacking us, that they feel a certain relief from the pressure.
We absolutely need leadership from the commander-in-chief on down for this strategy to work that says, we know you're doing it and it's unacceptable. And that message has to be each country, you can't look at this as a China problem or a Russia problem or Iran or North Korea. That's why I call it a code war. They're each watching what the other is doing, and so are all the other next level players who are developing capability in this space. Every action we take needs to be calibrated with the understanding that it's going to inform how hundreds of other countries use these new tools.
When you observe that it's ticking back up now and you say that, that's evidence that we sort of need to do it again, what's the it here? Is it merely bringing in a bunch of new cases, or is the it a consistent message between new cases and, you know, highest level and mid-level diplomacy that this is a priority issue for us? Like, what's the relationship between cases and diplomacy here?
A great point. It needs to be a coherent strategy. So the way I'd look at the all tools approach would be the excellent work that is done by FBI agents, intel analysts, and others to figure out who did it feeds the tools of the rest of the apparatus. And by the way, for that work to occur, you need the cooperation of the private sector. So you figure out who did it, your case. Then the criminal justice system is still one great tool for making public what it is that you found. It is not the only tool. It's not the method that was used, for instance, in the North Korean attack on Sony. The criminal case came much later. So there are other ways to make it public. Then it can feed things like the Commerce Department's use of the entity list to designate certain companies as ones for whom, if you do business, you need a special license because it's contrary to the national security interests of the United States. We saw the power of that tool with when it was applied to ZTE. Also, we mentioned briefly with the executive order that President Obama signed, which was the first time we had a executive order that allowed the use of sanctions, not just for those who steal the information, like those uniformed members of the People's Liberation Army, but importantly, for the companies or individuals that benefited from that stolen information. President Trump has re-signed that executive order, so it's still in place, just like we have with those who proliferate weapons of mass destruction or terrorism. So that's another potential tool. And it has to be calibrated with a diplomatic strategy where it is clear, one, that we have the will and the capability to keep raising the cost proportionally. We are going to do that until the behavior changes. And two, the off-ramp, that if the behavior changes, so will the policy, so that our adversary can make the cost-benefit analysis. Now, not every country is going to be as rational an actor, but I believe when it comes to China in this space, they very much are a rational actor. Their end strategic goal is not to blow up the world order, international order. They want to succeed in it. And so if you can convince them rationally, which requires taking action to change that calculus, it can change.
Talk to me about the private sector. A number of weeks ago, I had some people from Google in this podcast studio chatting about their advanced protection program, which, as you know, is a sort of elaborate, a much more elaborate set of anti-phishing protections designed to protect the most highly targeted potential users, people who are really kind of facing state actor level efforts. My reaction on talking to them was, you know, gosh, this should be basically standard. It should be, you know, every 13-year-old who has a Gmail account or a Facebook account or a Twitter account should just get used to the idea that login procedure is not simple. It's we all just need to get used to the idea that these are assets that we need to, that securing requires a measure of inconvenience, and this level of inconvenience is actually not all that bad. I actually don't mind it at all. I'm wondering, which private sector entities, by name or by category, in your judgment, are doing a good job here, and where the locus of the problem remains?
Look, still finding when I talk to Fortune 500 companies that they're wrestling with this new concept that that this is an area of risk management like other areas of risk management. I remember one of the stories to tell in the book is about after the Office of Personnel Management that the President of the United States tried to have his cabinet meet. And the first two times, the cabinet officials sent their experts, instead of going. So for Justice Department, the Attorney General wanted to send me and the Chief Information Officer. And the third time, they got a sternly worded email from the Chief of Staff and the Homeland Advisor that said, you can bring whoever you want, but you got to show up, because if you don't understand it as the top executive in language that you understand, you can't make what are fundamentally risk decisions. And that includes not just, kind of what you were raising, Ben, the latest and greatest in security, but decisions as to what should be connected to the internet at all. And boy, it is a vital time to have this conversation, because as bad as the risks and vulnerabilities that we are facing are right now as we play catch up, we're on the cusp of a major societal transformation, where we are moving to what is the buzzword, the Internet of Things. But essentially, we are connecting billions of new devices that have physical implications using the same insecure protocol. And that includes pacemakers that have gone into people's hearts. And what they did is they tested to see whether it worked. It worked great. What they didn't test is to see, would it work if a bad guy, a crook, a terrorist, or a spy didn't want it to work? And what they realized was, no, we didn't do basic protection, so an 11-year-old using publicly available software could hack and kill. And then a patch was rolled out. And we saw something similar with a vulnerability where you could hack in through the entertainment system and take over the braking and steering system of our cars. So whether it's the pacemakers in our hearts, the cars on our roads, the drones that are increasingly in our skies, if we don't incentivize people now to innovate into having security by design on the front end, the damage that we see won't be measured in billions of dollars, but it's going to be measured in lost lives.
Who's doing it well?
I'd say, you're starting to see in the couple different sectors, the financial sector, in part because the cases talk about the Iranian distributed denial of service attacks that hit 47 different financial institutions over a period of time was a real wake-up call to the sector plus regulators, and they have the funds. But I think they've taken good steps to not just protect their system, but focus on resilience. And they have a program called Financial Sector ARC that's working on what would happen if, no matter how much we've spent on trying to protect the worst from happening, it happens. What could we do to get back up and running again with something that's not otherwise connected? So financial sector, you're starting to see now a big change in the defense industrial base in terms of how products are designed. And in the automotive sector, post that recall, I think some companies have started to blend what used to be two separate segments, the cybersecurity information technology segment, into the design segment, so that they are thinking about these security issues from the front end. But there's a lot left to do.
One more question, then I'll let you go. As you look forward at these five countries that you've identified as critical here, and you think about the things we are doing, the things we've tried that haven't worked, the things we've tried that have worked, and the things we haven't tried at all that are available to us to try, what's the low-hanging fruit? What's the single thing that the U.S. government isn't doing that it could do that has the biggest impact in the code war?
I'll give four. One, Internet of Things. We need right now to, and the government needs to lead by microphone, by law, by regulation, to incentivize companies to build security in on the front end. Number two, cybersecurity workforce gap. That should be something that cuts across party. Through the Aspen Institute, we've laid out a plan to fix it, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs need to be addressed and can be. So it helps people get work and helps tackle the problem technically. So Internet of Things, cybersecurity workforce. Number three, sharing. There's no excuse for not having essentially a cyber 911. Everyone should know where to call when they've been the victim of a crime, and it should go to one place that gets fed then to the appropriate agency. So we need to do better on sharing information with the government. And lastly, deterrence. We need to work with partners around the world so that when we do great work identifying something like NotPetya, a ransomware that caused a global shipping company $500 million worth of damage, that caused FedEx $300 million worth of damage, that they face penalties that are commensurate to the crime.
The book is Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. My guest has been John Carlin. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Check out our new store online, the only place to get Lawfare mugs, Lawfare t-shirts, Lawfare onesies, and the Lawfare Challenge coin at www.thelawfarestore.com. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook or Twitter and give us a rating and review wherever you've found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.